Meeting of Parliament, Friday the 4th of July 2019, order of proceedings. The Senate has been ordered. The Honourable the Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I thank you for the standing order 7-3 to the Senate standing order 7-1 in order to proceed with the laying of the petition on the table. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Honourable the Chief Minister. I now put the question in the terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable the Chief Minister. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The petition is addressed to the devolved Parliament and reads as follows. The petition of the undermentioned signatories believes that the devolved British citizens should be democratically represented in Westminster. Furthermore, we believe that this is a right that all citizens should have. To be democratically represented in a parliament, where a plan that concerns us are being debated. Your petition requests all members of parliament to support the right of all devolved or British citizens to be democratically represented in Westminster, and that we keep our attained autonomous powers as per our 2006 constitution. Our double local sovereignty and our Chief Minister will always be our spokesperson. Moreover, we ask the honourable members of the devolved parliament to debate our petition and to include a number of our movements in the next constitutional reform committee so that the weight of 11,500 signatories are respected and listened to. Furthermore, on behalf of all our signatories, we present to all the honourable members of the devolved parliament a petition supported by 14,000 signatories, of which 11,500 were from devolved British citizens and 2,500 were mainly from Britain's visitors to Gibraltar, a copy of which was handed to the Majesty's Government of Gibraltar on the 27th of February 2019. And there followed the four signatories. All honourable members will be aware that last week I signed a direction under regulations made under the Sanctions Act 2019. Acting pursuant to that direction and all other relevant legal powers, the Council of the Port, ably assisted by the Royal Gibraltar Police and the Majesty's Customs and the Gibraltar Defence Police, detained a super tanker known as a very large crude carrier or VLCC by the name of the Great One. With my consent, the actions of our port and law enforcement agencies have been supported by the armed forces of the United Kingdom under a request for military assistance to civilian authorities. Last week, we acted because we had reasonable grounds to believe that this vessel was taking action to breach of established EU sanctions against Syria. These actions would be contrary to the law of Gibraltar, as the EU sanctions are contained in an EU regulation which has been directly applicable in Gibraltar since 2012. After laboratory testing, the cargo has now been confirmed to be 2.1 million barrels of light crude oil. We will not allow Gibraltar to be used or to be knowingly or unknowingly complicit in the breach of EU or other international sanctions or for any of the matters which our laws prohibit. With the powers that we took under the 2006 Constitution, come under the responsibility to act as required under European and international law when the time comes and the circumstances require it. Now that these actions have been taken, their consequences may be challenged and tested in the court. The regulations are made set out specific conditions to allow for such a challenge by any party, alleging that they have a claim to the vessel and its cargo. As the sanctions being enforced are established by the European Union, last week I wrote immediately after the detention of the vessel to the Presidents of the European Commission and of the European Council, Mr. Juncker and Mr. Tusk, setting out which EU sanctions we have enforced. I also provided this information directly to the Office of the High Representative, Ms. Federica Mogherini. These actions were, of course, taken after a unanimous decision of the divorce cabinet. The matter is now in the Supreme Court. Yesterday, the Royal Divorce Police announced that they had arrested the captain and the first mate of the Great One. The article stated that the sale of the captain's search of the vessel, where documents and electronic devices have been seized and examined. RGP and HM Customs also confirmed that officers involved in the investigation and suspected violation of these sanctions were interviewing both men under caution at RGP headquarters at Nemo House. Both have been accorded a court their legal entitlements and access to consular representation. The rules of actions in relation to the Grace One have been reflected in the world headlines in the past week. I therefore want to confirm to the House that all relevant decisions in respect to this matter were taken as a direct result only of the government of Gibraltar having reasonable grounds to believe that the vessel was acting in breach of established EU sanctions against Syria. There has been no political request at any time from any government that the Gibraltar government should act on not to act on one basis or another. The information which related to the alleged Syrian destination of the vessel and its cargo legally required Gibraltar to take the necessary action once the vessel freely entered the jurisdiction. The decisions of the government of Gibraltar were taken totally independently, based on breaches of existing law and not at all based on extraneous political considerations. These important decisions about breaches of our laws were certainly not decisions taken at the political behest or instruction of any other state or third party. In nations governed by the rule of law, decisions about the application of laws relating to what are potentially criminal offences are decisions made based on facts and legal analysis, and are not decisions made on the basis of political requests, whoever the requesting party may be. The provenance and origin of the cargo aboard the Great One has not been relevant at all to the cause of action. We have no desire, right or obligation, to do anything other than enforce the existing sanctions against the Syrian regime, as we are bound and legally required to do by EU Regulations 36/2012. Because these are not our sanctions, but the EU's sanctions. We are acutely conscious, in fact, of the environmental issues with the rise of the type of cargo that is held aboard Great Ones. There are obvious inherent risks in the maintenance of such a cargo, all of which are being skillfully mitigated by the Gibraltar Port Authority, both as to security and all other relevant concerns. I know this will, of course, be a concern to consumers both in Gibraltar and in neighboring states. The government will want to reassure us that we are working to ensure that there are no transboundary effects as a result of the maintenance of the cargo in the Great One in Gibraltar. Finally, I want to thank the brave men and women of our British Armed Forces, the Royal Gibraltar Police, and ICC Customs, the Gibraltar Defence Police, and the Gibraltar Port Authority for their work in securing the detention of the vessel and its cargo. The Speaker, I can be assured that Gibraltar remains safe and our international reputation is nothing but harmed by these actions. And Speaker, before I sit down, I think it is incumbent on me on behalf of the whole House, given that we are sitting during this relevant week, to welcome all the athletes of the International Ireland Games to Gibraltar and to the Invisible Games to be organized. I think that more of us, which is why we tend to be able to guarantee that we have a plan between clearing the agenda, which might address some of that. And I think it could be an excellent case, and I'm grateful even to honorable members of the office for reflecting on the fantastic facilities that have been provided for the game to be held. The legal opposition. Mr. Speaker, we welcome the statement by the Chief Minister in relation to the events here.
passing on the message, which is great one, in kind of court. It is right that our laws are upheld, our regulations are upheld, and we, of course, keep this situation under close observation, and any disputes that arise in the context of anything court. But we welcome the determination of the government to uphold the laws of war and the regulations. I think the message to the world that the people will uphold the laws and regulations and sanctions. In relation to our actions, of course, I again congratulate the government for holding the games, and indeed our young athletes and athletes from around the world who have spent on Gibraltar. And it's a very proud day for all of us in Gibraltar, here on Jesse, in his gold medal presented by the Chief Minister, and all the other athletes of Gibraltar to secure the medals on day for also participated and may not have succeeded in their participation in events. It's been very, very important for our community and the wider community.
Thank you.
collective the rights of location for our services and markets and political services, to make provision with special board for our services and commission to establish for our services and ombudsman, to make provision with special deposit guarantee scheme and investment compensation scheme, and recovery and resolution arrangements on our financing, to provide for a regulation of risk and security, respecting and rejecting, to make provision with respective market abuse, to provide for the control of insurance business transfers, to make provision with respective occupation and investment pension schemes, to provide for regulation of auditors and service practitioners, and for connected purposes, be read a third time. I now put the question, which is that a due for an act to provide for the regulation of financial services and market-based fiduciary services, in respect of the Gibraltar Financial Services Commission to establish the Financial Services Ombudsman, to make provision in respect of the Deposit Guarantee Scheme and Investor Compensation Scheme and recovery of resolution arrangements on their financing, to provide for the regulation of listing of securities for speculators and takeovers, to make provision in respect of market abuse, to provide for the control of insurance business transfers, to make provision in respect of occupational and personal pension schemes, to provide for the regulation of auditors and insolvency practitioners, and for collective purposes, be read a first time of the paper. Voted against. Carried. The Financial Services Act 2019. Mr. Speaker, I have no right to read it before I'll be read a second time. Personal government conduct of financial services is developed on a peaceful basis over time in response to market activity in particular, continues to European Union legislation. This has resulted in a significant increase in the amount of primary and secondary legislation to the point where there are various factors in the supply chain sector. This has also resulted in the times a lack of cohesion between the different pieces of legislation. Is a key part of the Legislative Reform Programme, LRP. A project launched in 2015 by myself, on behalf of the Legislative Government, and Samantha Blair, the CEO of the Board of Financial Services Commission. This is the single largest review and reform of our financial services laws. The work consolidates and recognises over 90 financial services legislative instruments into one act, and supporting sector-specific regulations. As well as the financial framework, the NF has concurrently implemented all EU transpositions and local initiatives during the lifetime of the programme, around 30 significant pieces of financial services legislation. These have all now been lifted into the new sector. The aims of the LRP are to update, rationalise and improve the current legislation to make it more navigable for both the regulator and the industry and to exist in consistencies between these sectors. The implementation of the NRP and the changes in the introduced account for the continuation of the current market access to United Kingdom within 2020 and the bill test to ensure regulatory alignment in terms of outcomes with the United Kingdom. As honourable members will remember, our legislation of the alignment is not the same as that of the UK. This alignment of regulatory outcomes is what HMDAG and the Motions Committee in the UK have agreed for our continued access to the UK financial services market. The bill provides a clear, more navigable and accessible legislative framework for financial services and the facility of innovation for both the regulator and the private sector. A key part of this bill is the introduction of the Decision Making Committee, or DMC, which is a committee independent of the executive of the GFSB and its board, and will be a key decision maker in all contended decisions. This innovation has been most welcomed by the private sector as a rule checking balance on the powers of the executive and GFSB. There are other significant resetting balances in the bill. Speaker, we have worked closely with our community of GFSB who have been responsible for the development and drafting of the bill. And I must thank Julie Federella and Ernie Seabat, who are with us today, who have worked very closely with Jim Keegan and I in working through every detail of this bill. Their work has been exemplary and the commitment relentless. We have met almost every Tuesday of the past 3 years to work our way through this bill in every detail. I am most grateful also to Ben, as well as to Peter Taylor, to Michael Farrell and Tara Wilson of the FSP, and Jonathan Bracken, the drafter. Speaker, I would also acknowledge and express my most sincere thanks to an exceptionally distinguished four-member of the House, who our work on this film. In order for us to be better auditors, we have meticulously scrutinized this film and provided us with investment advice on all aspects of the film, and I am most grateful to them for this. In the last 2 years, we have also consulted extensively with the Board of Finance and the Council on the different industry associations and the major areas of change, as well as on individual parts of the bill. I am very grateful for the major contribution that the Finance and the Council and the private sector have made towards this. Significant policy changes have been made as a result of this extensive engagement, including some changes that have been made public at the end of May for the rest of the members to support normal members today. The consultation process started in May 2017 when we consulted on the proposal to establish a special financial services tribunal. On the back of the feedback received, we changed the process and instead opted to maintain the current appeal to the Supreme Court instead, set up an independent decision-making committee. The consultant taking certain regulation decisions, and we also further consulted them specifically in June of 2018. The Secretary in January 2018 consulted by Federal Bill, which constitutes the orders and actions of authorized persons. The March 2018 consultant on the regulatory individual review with Part 8 of Federal. We received a significant amount of valuable feedback from the different industry associations and made substantial changes as a result. In August, we provided several consultations to each industry association, and each response paper contained responses to every point that was raised by them. The revised first consultation document Part 8 was inserted in October 2018. In June 2018, we consulted on the new geographic decision making committee, and in August, we decided on Part 11, which sets out its legacy's cross-sectoral sanctioning powers and related processes. Again, we received significant amount of feedback from the industry associations in May, which stands for change to the results. Other parts of the bill were shared with the Finance and the Council recent times in the last year. The Finance and the Council set up LRT subcommittees with industry members to review the different parts based on their experience and background. The draft of Part 2, which is regulated in political changes in Part 6, and the regulated in regulation, was sent to the Finance and the Council in October of 2018. The full draft of the new Act, with 17 of the integrated parts of the bill, was sent to the Finance Minister Council in December of 2018. Many of these exist to the content of current financial services legislation. A draft of Part 28 was sent to the FCC in January. At the start of February, the draft of Part 7 was also sent to the Finance Minister Council, and in early May of this year, we sent Part 3 and Part 10, which deal with the GFSC's contribution investigation plan. On the 24th of May, we shared the complete bill with the Council, which was published at the end of May. The Speaker, since the bill was published at the end of May, discussion with the Finance Centre Council has continued and has led to some further changes which are presented in the letter of amendment to the Liverpool Parliament today. This includes the introduction of a regulation in making power for the Minister to establish a procedure for complaints to be made concerning the GFSC's exercise of the function. Complaints to be made to both the GFSC and the Minister, or an independent person or body appointed for that purpose. And I would say that the result of the use of the session of the Finance and the Council is the introduction of a restriction on the GFSC's ability to publish statements at all stages of the regulation process. Government intends to further engage with the Council on private sector funds in the bill before its implementation, as and when will be required, and we are open to comments from all. Mr. Speaker, as part of this informing process, the Financial Services Commission posted 6 workshops to members of the different industry associations to familiarize the sector with the bill and its key concerning parts. These were informative and well received, and the team has also engaged with Honorable Mr. Daniel Peter to work them through the bill, offering insight into our thinking wherever requested. Mr. Peter expects the bill to come to force at the beginning of October, ensuring that the private sector has sufficient time to familiarize themselves with the content prior to its implementation. I am thankful as well for the significant support we've received from the Finance Centre Council and the individual associations in the sector. This has really been a commitment. Government, the GFSC, and the private sector working together to deliver the very best regulatory framework possible for our jurisdiction, and I am grateful to them all. Mr. Speaker, I will read the ruling I received from the Chair of the Gibraltar Finance Centre Council, Mr. Martin Rawls, and some of that today, for their first comment on the bill. Now, quote, on behalf of the GFSC, I would first of all like to thank you for the work done on the LRP. We acknowledge the significant time and effort which has gone into this modern and effective financial services legislation fit for the 21st century. The GMP is particularly welcome, which reduces crucial checks and balances to the historical powers of the GFSP. I think it's fair my view that if you give the GMP rights to increase settlement and regulation powers, then the bill will be balanced out by a deliberating body with intended members and will therefore be more readily acceptable by industries. Speaker, the Solicitor's Committee back in chair of ACCOM, reporting the final report on the 3rd of July as follows when commenting on the LRP. I quote, there are more checks and balances on the GFSP than ever before. Our enterprise functions are constrained by a level of independence from the new GFSP, ability to publish and much constrained. Powers of the London Ministry that have control of the executive of the GFSP are required or not, including power to remove the CEO in certain circumstances. The legislation is not perfect, nor near to perfect, and there are remaining areas of some disagreement in the industry and HMRG. But it is a very important progressive step in most areas of the whole, so we need to use the efficiency navigation of control of the legislation. The people of investment, which are most grateful, need to be put into context. We are dealing with over 650 pages for draft legislation, and it will be agreed totally on the fundamentals, but not on all the details. The most significant changes introduced by the bill are Part 267 provides for an umbrella, legislative framework, and a single authorization process for all sectors. As members will know, the previous legislation has different schemes for each of the different sectors involved. These set out the constant regulation for any activity, but introduced the legal concept of a general prohibition, meaning that no person carry out his activity unless authorized or exempt. The contravention of the prohibition is a criminal offence. By setting control of harmonized approach to the prohibition and obtaining permission to carry on regulated activities in the same threshold, conditions apply to all firms. These conditions set out in Rule 17. Part 7 also contains prospectorial supervisory powers and the related processes. A new regulated individual removes the senior individuals and is set by Part 8 of the bill. The RI regime. Intends to ensure the individual to perform important regulatory functions and fit and proper to undertake these roles, it requires the individual to seek approval from the FSC prior to taking up the position. The RIA regime extensively recognizes and formalizes the current system, which contains inconsistency across the sector in terms of individuals that will need to be identified or qualified as the FSC. The criteria for approving the approval process will be the same as what currently happens in practice. When the FSC considers the citizen party of the individual. We are essentially introducing an expanded regime applicable to all sectors. We are introducing a process of additional arrangements to ensure a smooth transition to the new regime after the legislation comes into effect. All individuals who have been approved in some way by the GFSC will be transitioned into the new regime and will not need to apply for approval process under the new legislation. The new decision-making committee, as I mentioned before, Mr. Speaker, has been established by Part 3. The GMP is independent from both the executive and the board of the GFSC, and will thus provide an enhanced level of independence to the final stage of decision-making, in respect of the decision that it will be assigned. The GMP is just to specify the results of decisions, including all final decision notices that include the censoring or supervisory power, unless the relevant party agrees with writing to the content of the GFSC board and notice. All urgent and direct decision notices and personal sanction or supervisory power will take effect immediately. All decisions on the publication of sanctions, decision notices to reject the firm's application for authorization or a regulated committee's application for approval, and decisions to acquire an exceptional cost contribution order. The DMC will have 6 members in the promises made by the Minister. All members must be ordinary residents in or carry out work in or from Gibraltar. There will be 3 lawyers with 10 years' experience and 2 members of significant financial service experience. The Minister will have the ability to appoint external members to consider particular cases or particular aspects of the case if all the 6 members are unavailable due to, for example, the public interest. All legal members will be appointed as chairs of the DMC, and the agreement must be taken by a panel of 3 members. The members of the chair will not be chairs of the appointment of the legal members being taken as chair. And in other cases, the chair can make the decision alone. The Speaker, prospectorial sense and regulated powers are set out in Part 10 of the bill, and this part is based on the relevant content from the financial services information gathering those criteria need to be taken into account by the domestic, whether the constitutional way to invoke such an order including the authority which will pursue appointing an inspector and releasing of the balance as is commissioned in appointing an external inspector as opposed to an internal staff member. These are all three provisions. There is an appeal right on the fact that the DLC decision and the court must have regard to the same criteria when considering it. There are also additional requirements that the DLC because the decision appointing an external inspector in terms of the criteria is needed to consider. Appeal rights are no longer applicable in relation to the power to request to be found to commit to the two persons in court or the power to appoint an inspector. This is necessary to arrive the nuclear regulatory outcomes. In the UK, there are no appeal rights in these files or credentials as they are regarded as part of the regulatory process. There will be an appeal right for the cost of contribution orders for the sector, and the right to judicial review will apply to the initial decisions by the other. There is a new requirement on the Commission to find the appeal person for policy statements that they have now until it's applied to the trial. On the level of the bill, set by cross-control sanctions and related procedures. After they have found the common external sanction trial, it will be harmonized across the board. They will enable the executive to respond proportionately to contraventions depending on their gravity. The judges have already mentioned the powers in respect of most inspected amendments, and applying them across the board is quite close to gaps in the current framework. Supervised powers have also been set out in various recent EU directives. And also, we have to say that it is something that is potentially something that is going to be a foreigner. And I will speak on that in a few moments. But today, I want to concentrate on a point of discussion, a point of spokesperson in the cost of the report, to provide more action rather than a specified regulatory decision. I'm Gibraltar, Parliament, the motion, and Commission to review work practices and demand time for management to do some movement. We've got the power to examine
a major
Corinthians. And last week, Friday of last week, I met with the Honourable Gentleman officials, both officials from his department and also officials from the FSC. I gave him my views. I looked at it, in fact, some of the proposed amendments that I made to them last Friday had actually been taken on board, and therefore I'm just going to go through that so that the House can see what I was proposing. Of course, these are five issues that appear, which I've already made by these members of the House. But if one looks at the appointment of the Inspector in section 137, section 137, 1, it begins by saying the Secretary may appoint a person who is considered to be competent to do so, an inspector, to investigate on the FSC's behalf the affairs of a person in subsection 2, if he has reasonable grounds to suspect that the person is contravening the requirement imposed by or under the Act, or if it appears to be that on other grounds there are good reasons for doing so. So, contravention or other good grounds, that means effectively unlocking the jurisdiction for the appointment. And in fact, it's a far better section, than the section of the city that exists alone in the 2007 Act, in respect of which there is confusion as to whether the FSC has to go through a series that is set by a number of criteria, I think it's in subsection 3, or whether it can do so in a standalone of section 1. I think it's a better section. However, when one looks at subsection 3, it says, in deciding whether to appoint an inspector who is not a GFSC employee, in other words, who is not a GFSC employee, but the FSC must have regard to the functionality of the cost of doing so, having regard to any of the seriousness of expected contravention or matter to the right to good reasons for appointing an inspector on other grounds, and then he goes further. But effectively, what he's attempting to do is say, right, okay, the core of the section on refugee assistance, contravention, is section 1, contravention of a requirement imposed by the Act. That's what we that is subsection 3 says. The problem is this. We decide whether to appoint an inspector who is not a GFSC employee. In other words, even if a GFSC employee, in a period of a matter of construction, Mr. Speaker, that you then don't have to go through that second loop, which is the second loop that basically says that you've got to consider proportionality and seriousness of the suspected contravention. I made that point to the FSC on Friday. It doesn't appear to be taken. You can say you can do it, or you can do it now, but you can say it. It's a simple point, it's going to get unbroken, so I'm going to get away. The first of the words, you've got to give it to employee, linked directly to the cost. In other words, because the cost could be paid by the firm at a later date, that requires capability found in the expected report. In order for the GFSC not to use somebody internally, which is very much cheaper, if they want to go outside the GFSC, as all of them know very well, where the cost can become quite serious, there is a further barrier that they need to cross in terms of justifying that that cost is worth taking on board, but only in respect of whether it is an external appointee, not somebody from within. So that is limited solely when they want to go outside. So as soon as they choose to go outside, they'll have a higher barrier to cross in terms of the proportionality of the cost justifying that act. Yes, but that is the way that it was explained to me, and it doesn't make sense for this reason with respect to the minister. I bear in mind that perhaps it's because I'm a litigator, I look at these things, almost potentially cause a problem in court later on. I can't divorce myself from my training. I'm essentially respecting nominal instead. That cannot, that really doesn't stack up for this reason. To the extent that what you're saying effectively is, look, if you go to an external person because the costs are higher, you've got to look at the personality of costs. And I said, well, I don't think it's good to think it about. I would say, I understand it completely. But it's not the unity to that.
Relevant
whether my concerns are made out that might be my concerns have been communicated to the minister. So I have information the minister to essentially what the government views are in relation to that. One of the views that I wish to express in relation to this question, I wish to say this in relation to skilled persons. It's more common than skilled persons, but also, in our view, be invasive for a lack of skill. Of course, we accept that the method invasive as the appointment of an inspector. Two arguments that to those who are appointed as inspector apply here, a review by the decision-making committee will provide an effective, inexpensive, and quick alternative to court proceedings for the fairness of the proposed appointment that should be assessed. The cost of the skilled persons report should also be something the DSC should decide upon. At present, the bill provides that the licensee should pay for this, and there is no discretion for the DSC to pay. If it turns out that the appointment of the skilled person is not justified, and they have already produced the report, it would, in our view, be perfectly unfair and fair for the licensee to have to pay for it. And I accept that there is a distinction in how you appoint a skilled person and look at an inspector appointed by the DSC. A skilled person is appointed by the licensee, so there is a contractual relationship between the skilled person, the consultant, and the licensee. But it is something that ought to be decided by the DSC. But maybe just the Honourable Minister, my experience is in relation to this. What invariably happens is this. There is, in a lot of the cases, I should say, use the word very, like, very rare cases that I have taken up to. If necessary, upon an inspection, there is an appeal and there is an application for pending appeal, a brief pending appeal. The court will stay and freeze the decision pending the appeal. There is then a negotiation between the licensee and the FSC, and the FSC says, well, okay, we will accept the skilled person. It's not a reputational concern for the licensee, because the licensee does not want the appointment of an inspector, because that indicates that the licensee has done something quite bad and wrong, because that's what we're dealing with, is when we're dealing with the appointment of an inspector. The licensee will agree to the appointment of an inspector. So it has to be really reluctant, because there are licensees that may have done absolutely nothing wrong to justify the appointment of a skilled person. So having a DSC review the decision of a skilled of the officer appointed a skilled person, in our respectful view, is also improbable. And it is look at a big number of points. There are some very criticisms there, of course there are, but it's a penalty that the government can take from the fact that I'm suggesting that these decisions come under the purview of a commission that the government is proposing to create as a consequence of this act, and that is a huge plus for the government and for those that have been the architects of this bill. There also, Mr. Speaker, I also said that I would talk about very briefly as to provide more action other than a specified regulatory decision. Because there is an athletic balance of power between the legislature and the licensee, whenever the question will be taken in a course of action, they will otherwise not wish to take. It is not uncommon for licensees to receive very lengthy letters from the DSC setting out deficiencies, as perceived by them, and suggesting that unless certain action are taken, that is suspended or revoked. And in fact, this is something that the Finance Centre Council set out in their own submission to the government, and it's quite a key example. The suggestion that regulated individuals or persons holding notifiable persons tickets of an atmosphere to design. There is no formal decision, but there is a suggestion that an atmosphere takes certain steps to implement particular measures and the requirement for more regulatory capital to be done. These are three examples that the Finance Centre Council associated with that. I wonder when that has been taken into account. I guess so, there is a few difficulties in my view here in relation to the coronation procedure, particularly with complex pieces of education statistics, because it really is very difficult to see whether the language is taken on board a particular point. As I say, I was consulted and I gave my views on Friday last week. The government on the 10th, that was 2 days ago, which produced a whole host of amendments. I guess that concern has been taken into account in the amendments, or I'm not supposed to do it. I apologize to the minister, but it appears to me that the submission that will be made by the Finance Sector Council will make full and deserve consideration and approval within the agreement. The speaker also has publication. Now, section 616 to 618 of the bill appears in the publication of sanctioning actions in section 13. Section 116 refers to the publication of sanctioning actions where health safeguards that we can restrict publication are set out in section 617. Now, those are welcome. Crucially, however, the legislation only covers the publication of sanctioning actions and nothing else. No other decision by the DFSC to publish anything else in respect of the LFSC is reviewable by the DMC. The Honourable Minister is certainly in the post of the intervention that they will be able to claim evidence, as I understand it, which will deal with it. That's how I understood it. If there is a decision with this court to explain why, get that, why anything else that is published by the FSC that is not the publication of a sanctioning action is not something that can be reviewed by the DMC, unless again I've got it wrong, and somewhere in there I have not spotted it. And finally, Speaker, on the Speaker, the proposed changes to the immunity section will see power which is strength the defense of immunity significantly reduced. In other words, the immunity will apply to more situations than it does now or even did in 1989. Section 10.2 of the Financial Services Commission Act 2007 has been restricted by the law. Section 10.2 of the 2007 Act makes the power of the subsection A to F to which the defense of immunity simply does not apply, irrespective of whether persons seeking redress of agency of the state can establish bad faith. The 2007 Act expanded on the power to which the immunity did not apply from its predecessor, the Financial Services Commission Act, in 1989. Now, Mr. Speaker, I've got to be careful what I say here because there is litigation on this particular point. But we know that there is a high-profile case at the moment in the new Supreme Court where there was a publication by the FSC, and the point there to be decided is this publication covered by the immunity in the existing legislation? If it's not covered, if it is covered, then of course there is no right to anybody within the FSC for making those statements, unless you can say that those statements were made in bad faith. That would be the position. And that's what the government is attempting to get to by extending the immunity in this bill. I think that the government ought to be cautious. In this day and age, whereby publications really are instantaneous and can reach members of the community, indeed, as my fiction book, perhaps in 1989, I think even in 2007, although by then the internet had already been quite established, but certainly in 1989, commentaries, I think that the damage potentially to an individual's reputation today is much more than the damage then. And if I were to take the decision in 1989 not to have an immunity extend to certain publications, even Britain, because of the way that we're getting nowadays, can reach more people while we ought to be extremely positive and not extend to the immunity to those areas. Again, I conclude by saying that I congratulate the government. I thank the Parliament for its indulgence for listening to the news that we have expressed on this side of the House. There are critical comments that have been said are intended to be constructive, and I congratulate the Minister for what is an excellent piece of legislation.
The Honourable Roy Kinson.
Thank you. Bill, there is a technical prohibition on certain accepting a member of the corporate pension unless it has been approved by the GFSC. And my pension, my sector pension bill, talks about body holding class 7, class 16 licenses. So, this is a slight interference, that's a hard fair word. They don't seem to be entirely in sync with each other. Especially, for example, when you want for example, in definition, the financial services bill talks about pension schemes, personal pension schemes, or disabled pension schemes, whereas the private sector pension bill talks about pension classes, but doesn't talk about schemes.
Absolutely every single industry provides an excellent customer service.
other words, whatever it is, in terms of some action that we are going to take, other than the focus of the wherever there's a warning notice to evolve, wherever there is a reporting notice of any nature, any sanction, any publication, it goes to the community. So I think we carve out of the existing powers to quote my own friends and the community of the park, have been very captured by the DSP, and I'm entirely confident that it will work. But if I experience over the coming months, if the community don't get it to do it, of course we look at it. And this is work in progress. This is our first step towards this sort of decision-making process, and maybe changing to make improvements and incidents to improve. And I think that's something that can be ongoing with yourself, with the private sector, and with the regulator to ensure that it's as best as possible. This year is a significant change in how we work in the past, and we have to work closely today to make sure that we can take advantage of the opportunity to the bring them. Not accept appropriate for giving us the regulatory arm of the New Zealand government to have a sector. Wouldn't it pass the worst of my decision? Well, why was there a right to decision? I'm trying to remember why there was. And that is because the 2030 Act gave the government the power to fund the sector and it forced the president to use the funds to pay those costs. I know you think that you're going to write to the top of the 90%, you will have to have a right to appeal. We have removed the right of cost. Yes, well, the right to be received in the greatest of all terrors, I want to be the right to put it on this point, I think it's very important to be raised, and it's giving us that advice. So, we don't want to have by sexual energy from home, it's a very question involved in the conflict in this question was, if you have a good question, the left, so the cost has been removed, the expense of the investments, and only those capabilities will return after contributing costs. And if you increase the cost, and I don't cost, that thing will be good. So all of those costs that are required to be put in the education, especially by the courts, are there. And that's why, when we've exposed the value of education, we come back and expand and accept it. So, in this bill is called Protestant. And if it was wrong with that, it would be called Protestant. And that is what it would be. So we start to capture the vote, and that is the intention of government to do that as a special part. So if our end of every factor, and we go through it line by line, and make it right, and for us, we will capture it. This is that is the intention. If you look at the claim from publication, if you look at the letter of amendment, this section towards the end, publication statement, section 6170(1), everything that you said. This is what I mentioned in my addressing work that we have to engage in the higher center council. We have raised this point, we had agreed with the point, and we have made the change. The other point was to complete the secret before the decision came from the honourable member addressed that point. So that has been dealt with, and indeed is with the level of relevance on the level of the board. I think that as a result of looking at publications in the way that I just described, it no longer becomes relevant. Why? Because the publications that the industry are entitled to make is not just the investigation, but any publication is limited and described by the DRC type of publication. I also have to say that some of the people who have said that this is an oriented couple to the office. We are grateful to the judge, because we see the regulators in the world have met with their community, have media, the reality of that place, which is not the problem, but then we are affected by the community. If you want them to be good, positive people, so that it is what we take in the second one onto the board of financial services committee. So I believe that part is right, and do some things. Because I think I've covered all the points that the honourable member has raised, and greatly
that a bill for an act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005 be read in first term.
I ask for the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005 be read in first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. The Stamp Duty Amendment Act 2019.
call for the Bill for an Act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005 in the Edinburgh Container. Mr. Speaker, the purpose of this bill is to enshrine and law budget measures from the 2014 and 2015, which to date have been implemented administratively, and by the budget method from 2018. In summary, the measure is followed. In 2014, the Chief Minister announced that in order to support the purchase of family homes, no sanctions would be payable by first and second term buyers on the first £250,000 irrespective of the total cost of all the homes. In 2015, the Chief Minister declared that in order to assist working families with a purchase of their homes and those who may need to move to alternative accommodation as their family compensation, would increase the threshold set down in the 2014 budget measure from £250,000 to £250,000. And Mr. Speaker, in relation to the second sanction in 2018, the Chief Minister declared that the sale of any property sold in an affordable home selling on behalf of the government in the preceding 4 years, that is to say, a property with 62 territories and one person use, would attract a new special tax duty of 7.5% of the total sale price. Clause 3.3 gives effect to this measure. The special tax duty will be payable by the seller over and above any relevant stamp duty on the sale that may be paid by the buyer. The special stamp duty will not apply to the sale of any part of the government's equity in the property. Moreover, Mr. Speaker, an exception to the duty applies where the Land Management Committee directs that this duty is not payable due to a forced sale, including cases of marriage or relationship breakdown, or where a family moves to a larger property as a meritorious upgrader to another, more affordable housing estate. This condition was introduced in order to put an end to a legislation for investment and excess profit in the sale of the more affordable housing estate described in the legislation. I recommend it to the
If I have a question, I'm going to go to the speaker and then I'm going to go to the speaker. I now put a question, which is that the bill for an act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005 being read the second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Stamp Duty Amendment Act 2019.
I beg to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today with all honourable members.
The honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of this bill be taken today. Target for the year 2015, contingent target for the year 2030, and to provide for progress targets for the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, to study the Committee on Climate Change, to confer power amendments between both climate change treaties and public bodies, to make further provisions about mitigation of and adaptation to climate change, to make provisions about energy efficiency, to make provisions about the reduction of and recycling of waste, to make other provisions about climate change and for climate services. The Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister has been in the letter of July, which introduced an amendment. As well, the effort to move that a bill for an act to set a target for the year 2050 as amended to 2045, and an interim target for the year 2030, and to provide the project targets for the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, to establish the Committee on Climate Change, to confer power on ministers to impose climate change treaties on public bodies, Economic circumstances of the for registering or trying to report regularly to Parliament on devoted emissions and on the progress being made towards the emissions reduction target. This guidance provides for separate reports to be made in respect of the progress target, achieving climate and the 2045 target. The bill specifies information that the report must contain. This includes whether the targets have been met, and if they have met, the report must explain why.
Environment and the global environment and the potential consequences of
do know that in the UK there is already a model of such a committee, and indeed the Climate Change Committee does exist. But the legislation as proposed here is different from the legislation as enacted in the UK. And I wondered if the Minister has looked at that legislation and if so, why he has decided not to follow that UK model. And I say this because in the UK it appears that the Climate Change Committee is a body corporate. Along the lines of perhaps the end of us here in the world. And in being a body corporate, of course, it automatically achieves a degree of independence from government, which is kind of strikes me as something that would be positive in the case of a climate change committee, because hopefully, terms of reference will allow it to drive the agenda very much on climate rather than have potentially the agenda driven by any particular minister who happens to be in office at any particular time. But I say this because, of course, the legislation as we are as set out in the bill does give the minister a great deal of authority to regulate the Climate Change Committee. It allows it to establish the minister to establish the basic constitution, membership, remuneration, procedures of the committee, the execution of documents by the committee, the creation of subcommittees. Pretty much every activity that the committee might undertake can be regulated, or presumably would be regulated by the minister. And that doesn't feel quite right to me. I think it would be appropriate for such a committee to have greater autonomy from government, to be able to, some of them, pressurize government. You know, perhaps one of the ministers of the environment in the future will be keen to be targeted, as the current minister no doubt is. So the point is, having an autonomous committee with its own constitution, if you like, would separate those powers somewhat. And I think should that committee more teeth with respect to its activities. And I just wonder if the minister has given that consideration and what his thoughts are around that. Other than that, no significant points to raise with respect to the rest of the bill and the state in regard to the responsible most working people for the government.
Mirando por la ley, ¿no?
Mr. Speaker, I would like to congratulate the government for tabling this bill for climate change. Climate change represents an existential threat that, if left unchecked, will alter our existence as we know it. As we also know, the protection of our environment is a core pillar of my politics. And that of our party, Together Gibraltar. Scientists have overwhelmingly reported their alarm at the ever-accelerating impact our consumers' lifestyles are having on the planet. As we know, the rapidly rising temperatures brought about as a direct result of disproportionate levels of greenhouse gases produced will lead to rising sea levels. This is extinction, mass migration, water shortages, warmth, and the list goes on. Our planet will become uninhabitable. It is incumbent on every nation on this planet to take action and reverse this process. This will require an overhaul in the way we presently do things and go about our business as humans. We will need to make fundamental lifestyle and socio-economic changes to live in harmony with our environment. In terms of general targets, it is a shame then that since the government announced a state of climate emergency back in March 2019 that they committed to carbon neutrality by 2030, that this stage has been pushed back 20 years more to 2050. But it is the government's view that climate action is not that urgent. The United Nations and their Panel on Climate Change, the most knowledgeable and credible organization on the issue, tells us that we have just over a decade to mitigate the effects of climate change. In the words of General Assembly President Maria Fernanda Espinosa Garcia, quote, "We are the last generation that can prevent irreparable damage to our planet. It is the position of the panel that 11 years are all that remain to avert catastrophe. This is not scaremongering or conspiracy theory. These are scientifically based, measured institutional positions on what's going on. We must open our eyes. This is the world we live in, whether we like it or not. We have to be brave. area is enough. Democracy is real priority, and not caveated to other agendas such as profit, comfort, or vote. We have never time left to stop climate thinking. Even though it might feel that way sometimes, we are not an entity detached from this planet. We will suffer the same consequences as everyone else, and we share the exact same responsibility. We must understand once and for all that is the most important challenge facing our communities. This bill is a welcome step in the right direction, but like is often the case when dealing with this kind of legislation, it is a little too late. And I believe we can do more. We should take the example of Norway, for example, who in its parliament in 2009 agreed to bring the target forward 20 years to 2030 in response to the Paris Agreement on climate action, which was reached in December by nearly 200 countries. Norway has now agreed on a 2030 target to cut net greenhouse gas emissions to zero, 20 years earlier than the previous deadline, by paying for emission costs abroad that correspond to its own emissions to reach the target. This is not ideal, as some of these emissions will continue to happen in the future in exchange for carbon credits, but it shows commitment and ambition. This bill simply does not say enough of that. I therefore believe that this bill should set a target to make the world carbon neutral by 2030, not to have achieved an 80% reduction by 2050. In terms of progress targets, Mr. Speaker, many believe that every 4 years is leaving it too long. This should be reviewed yearly as a step move fast and we need to respond accordingly. Also, 4 years is terribly inefficient as progress will need to be reviewed continuously. Again, how will emissions be counted and calculated? By the amount of fuel used? These are at best based on estimations from different sectors. We need real data. In connection with the Climate Action Fund, wouldn't it be better to commit a minimum percentage of our budget? Certainly, have a climate emergency budget so that whoever is in power needs to adhere to it. The Climate Action Fund found a big following nearly, Mr. Speaker. The European Commission has recently put forward its future budget design, which includes spending a quarter of its entire finances on tackling climate change. Obviously, the Commission is not a state with its burdens and obligations, and therefore the percentage sounds disproportionate. But I believe the commitment of a substantial 6% of our budget in law would create an economic incentive that would help us ensure the application of these policies. Mr. Speaker, in addition, with regard to carrier bag charges, the charges for the supply of carrier bags, seeing as this is supposed to be a bill that goes well into the future, does this bill not commit to banning all single-use plastic carrier bags? This is what is really needed, Mr. Speaker. Now, nevertheless, Mr. Speaker, this bill is some positive steps, but we also want to take in implementing measures that will have an impact on a local and international level. Indeed, an extremely ambitious objective has been set to make Gibraltar a leading jurisdiction in the mitigation of climate change. Crucially, it brings the environment into the decision-making processes across government bodies. Anyone who has watched any of Greta Thunberg's speeches will have heard her say that the time to talk is over and that we need drastic action now. I feel, as many do in Gibraltar, that this bill does not go far enough to deliver this action. Mr. Speaker, in terms of the Independent Auditor Committee, Mr. Speaker, there is little accountability applied to the ministers in the application of the standard set. The main bodies mentioned are the committee, which is purely advisory and is selected by the minister, and the monitors, which are directly appointed by the minister, to check on public bodies. Would it not be wiser to appoint an independent commission or body to provide governance? Mr. Speaker, in terms of deadlock closures, there are numerous considerations allowed for that provide convenient deadlock closures. The National Mitigation Plan, point 4, prioritizes economic imperatives and least cost to the national economy, not so great, Mr. Speaker. In terms of moving targets, Mr. Speaker, targets for net emissions fall way below. allowing Article 3A allows the committee the ability to modify the target figures at will, and 11 Article B allows the minister to meet the deadline for submitting progress targets and then to set them as soon as is reasonably practical. A time frame here would be advisable to ensure it gets the attention it deserves. In particular, there is a lot of vagueness. For Section and Transport 63.1, this is extremely vague terminology to cover this section's commitment saying, and I quote, "The Minister may make provision for the reduction of the vehicle emissions from transport," unquote, or may not. The statute is non-committed. The speaker still on the transport section and the carbon points for electric vehicles, where will they be located exactly? Roadside? New residential flats? New stations? How will this infrastructure be built and paid for? And when is it possible? What percentage of vehicles would have access to electronic charging points? An impossible requirement for the government to replace 25% of its vehicles with electric vehicles. Federal commitment to all government vehicles being electric by 2030. Compromise. I also believe, Mr. Speaker, that we should implement restrictions of vehicles accessing areas of Gibraltar depending on emission levels of vehicles. However, Mr. Speaker, for that to materialize properly, we need live data, which we don't have at the moment. So, Mr. Speaker, the following questions arise from the relevant section. 3.4a, periodically. How often is periodically? How often will monitoring be done? Where will this be published, and how soon can we expect the technology? 3.4b, limiting emissions. We currently do not count the carbon footprint per capita of the fuel we sell in Bunker. So how will this be calculated, and what is the basis to measure reduction? 3.4b, waste management. When can we expect the sewage treatment plant to be started, let alone completed? 3.4e, sinks and reservoirs. With all the construction, will there be some sort of green belt aside from the new woodland area? 3.4j, promote to water. How exactly? We still burn LED, and despite promises that renewables will increase, it is still at a paltry 2% output. 3.5 and 6. Mr. Speaker, I fully agree that government shall ensure that policies, programs, and projects are, to the extent possible, designed in a manner that improves resilience to the impact of climate change. Unquote. However, given the amount of overdevelopment and how projects have been announced, for example, Victoria Keys being a case in point, before assessing the environmental impact, it sounds a bit follows. 3.8, to the extent possible, keeps a huge margin for inaction, potentially socioeconomic factors above climate change, which defeats that purpose. Mitigation going to take place and where is the data going to come from? On visibility, Section 8Q ensures that adequate information is made available to the public. Why stop it adequate? Why not inform the public fully? It also allows for public participation in respect of certain plans and programs relating to the climate system. Will this be applicable for the Victoria Treatment project and indeed for the new 2019 Planning Development Plan? Will this development plan reflect the sinks and reservoirs mentioned in the bill? In terms of net emissions, the target for net emissions over the period between 2020 and 2024 may have to be less than the net emissions recorded in the previous four-year period between 2016 and 2020. Given that the energy power station will be coming online towards the end of 2019 and that there is a 30% reduction in emissions as a result, this target is widely targeted. It is shockingly unambitious, in fact. It essentially means that we do not need to do anything for 4.5 years in this respect. This is because of the Climate Action Fund. The Climate Action Fund appears to be discretionary, showing no link to investment levels or obligatory policy inclusion. By contrast, the EU has expressed a wish to dedicate a quarter of its spend towards climate action. Speaker, in connection with poor track record, in 2015, Gibraltar, under this government, applied for an EU grant coming up with a National Renewable Energy Action Plan. This plan committed us to hitting 1 and 2% of our total energy production, according to the Honourable Minister for the Environment, waiting for this target. Similarly, the manifesto of the same government promised the electorate a choice grant, but not a bridge has been made yet. Even with written commitments, this government has failed to come remotely close to meeting their targets. The simple fact of the matter, Mr. Speaker, is that they are merely paying lip service to the growing pressure from the general public and the recent students and the ESG strike for climate action. While well intentioned on the face of it, this bill is ready to get our clauses, adaptable targets, and is self governed by the ministers and committees elected by the same body. There is no governance, no external audit as allowed for. Nor, Mr. Speaker, does it pave the way for a green economy or at least a more environmentally friendly one when each step of the way is met with obstacles such as economic gas clauses and ministerial interference. Mr. Speaker, on the important matter of cross-border collaboration, I believe also, and something I haven't seen anywhere in the bill, that we should have collaboration with those entities from across the border who have the genuine best interest of our shared environment at heart, as well as, of course, they don't have a covert anti-libertarian agenda. The environment in this state is a cross-border issue, whether we like it or not. We need international collaboration on climate change. This is a problem that we cannot face alone. What good would it be if we managed to ban all of our emissions while we continue to be sprayed with contaminants from across the bay? We need to find a way to work with bona fide agents across the border to improve the air quality in our region. Cross-border interstate, for example, Mr. Speaker, particularly focused on forwarding a green agenda would be a great start and a step in the right direction. In terms of fossil fuels, Mr. Speaker, in order to move the border away from our reliance on fossil fuels, the government needs to show a commitment to 1, real investment, 2, really changes to our infrastructure, and 3, real incentives for businesses and individuals. Without this focus, Mr. Speaker, timely targets and independent planning, the removal of ambiguity and get our clauses showing real commitment, this bill will fail to deliver the action required. Despite all my reservations about the bill, I shall be voting in favour of it, given that all the other topics in general, a climate change bill is always better than not having one. Thank you.
Honourable Roy Clinton.
Thank you very much. I'd like to have a very narrow point in respect to the bill, that is, in respect to the climate action fund. Mr. Speaker, this fund, according to Clause 48, will have separate terms of legal personality independent and distinct from national government. While the cable rent-range contract requiring private property and being accepted so necessary for and for the function. But I also need to clarify, indeed, the comments in my honourable colleague in respect of the climate change committee that doesn't have a separate legal personality. Why is it that for the climate action fund, the field that they should have a separate legal personality but not the climate change committee? And also, Mr. Speaker, I would ask him if he could explain why, in terms of its creation and the way it holds money, why the government has not actually set up a special fund under the normal procedure for the creation of the Public Finance Audit Control Act, where it could simply set up a climate change designated special fund. Why has it gone to this degree? I think, Mr. Speaker, I'm concerned that the money in the fund will be only controlled by a board with 3 people, 2 of which are actually appointed by the government. And interestingly enough, Mr. Speaker, under 43, the only other member is a principal among persons knowledgeable in climate change matters. And I'm quite curious to see what that language doesn't even appear on the Climate Change Committee. I find it hard to reconcile the language in this section with the language in the section on the Climate Change Committee, which is what email reference to people involved in all climate change matters. And I don't understand the speaker just explaining on the 48th basis
as all those great expenses of the climate change committee. And I also note, and I think one of the ladies made reference to this, a very wide discretion in here, Mr. Speaker, as to what the minister may do by regulation. He can prescribe certain functions, activities, and initiatives that may allow to be financed by the fund. I find that this, again, gives the government a wide discretion. And of course, Mr. Speaker, in terms of 48 we're really to buy things, and I am asking by whom. Is this to be a fund that will be covered by the principal auditor? Or is this the intention that this is an audit by an independent auditor? And if so, Speaker, what type of legal personality do we envisage? Is this to be a body corporate, and like I know colleague said that as well, or is this to be an incorporated entity? I think we should know at this stage what type of entity we're talking about, if it is to be held in fund by the appropriated by Parliament or gifted to it by the public. What is it the Minister intends? And how is the Minister entirely comfortable that the administration of this fund by any three people is appropriate? Any other honourable members of the committee? Yeah, the honourable Joe McCallum. I really want to pick on the wider issues that we're facing going on the technicalities of the business and the government agreement, really, on the side of the housing open crisis. I think it's the state of the business of the climate danger is progressing much faster than the state of the attempt to do something about it. The latest comment on where we are is that of which starts to the Commonwealth, then we've got 18 months left to save the planet. Another trajectory. In my vision, contribution to the budget where I referred to this, I think that there is, I think, a debate, which is a global debate, which is not taking place, but which will be forced upon us by the passage of time and the worsening of the situation. The worries of the scientists are not having the effect that they should have. The conference that I was fortunate to attend in London recently, organized by the Ambassador George Porter, which was addressed by the head of the British Antarctic Service, looking at what is happening in Antarctica, said two incredibly alarming things, and this is a scientist that is not trying to alarm anybody, also given talking at it. The planet that he was referring to was the one we are living in, but was looking at it with a detachment that scientists tend to develop when they look at things. And one thing that he said was that the battle has already been lost in respect of the North Pole, because there are now too many political issues and vested commercial interests, and allowing a shorter passage of ships by running a polar vessel breeze in the waters around it is going to become predominant, and that everybody is already trying to position themselves in order to exploit the middle world of the land that will be revealed when the ice is not there. So it seems that the view of the scientists is that whatever we do, that is no longer under the threat of the top of the cover. And then he said that in the case of the South Pole, if the ice there melted, then we would be talking about an increase in sea level of 30 meters. We were sitting in the second floor of the foreign office, and he told us we would all be swimming there if that happened. And the other information that he provided, which is
evidence of what is happening behind me is that the latest science on the alcohol is that they've been able to bring out a column of ice that goes down as far as the ice goes, around 8 kilometers where it goes. And that they've been able to find a way of preserving that ice so that they can make prices like you do when you do a time. And the oldest bit of the ice at the bottom of this column is 800 million years. And they were able to examine by controlling the melting of the ice, which contains frozen air bubbles, the CO2 content in parts per million. And in the 800 million years, there's never been a problem in the 800 million years when it's been at 400 parts per million, which is what it is now. It's never been higher than 330 parts per million. So, we're talking about a situation where there is now evidence that there is a correlation between CO2 and climate change and the temperature of the planet. Then it is not just that it always happened or has it happened without us being there and it has happened in the past. Well, we weren't there 800 million years ago. So, I think the mounting evidence presents a worsening picture. And a worsening picture is related to a certain time scale. 2020 may be too late, or 2030 may be too late, or 2050 may be too late, or it may be too late already. But certainly, I believe that the most important thing we need to do, apart from the physical action that we take, to reduce CO2 emissions in Gibraltar, which is no difference at all to the scenario where I am based. But we have to do it. Because otherwise, if everybody takes a position that what I do doesn't make a difference, then nobody will do it. I think that we have to convey the sense of urgency that this entails at every opportunity and everywhere we go. We individually, as members of government, and we collectively as government and opposition. It is clear and it's serious. I think that the Parliamentary Assembly for the Mediterranean, and I took the opportunity of explaining to them the solution that multiple parts from the climate emergency, and I urge the organization to recommend to all the parliaments in the Mediterranean to follow the example of what we've done and the UK has done, in the hope that we keep on raising the level of consciousness and the level of concern that needs to exist before radical action needs to be taken. And the radical action goes to the very root of what I know about, which is economics. Society is really the society. And economics is built on a premise that exploiting the resources of the planet to in ever increasing quantity, to have ever increasing level of consumption, is what we should be doing. It never assumed in the history, in the short history of economic and social science, that they will have any effect other than a breakdown. And the real debate in economics has not been about whether exploitation is good or bad, but who should take the lion's share of what we exploit. Well, what the planet is telling us is that while we're all talking about who takes it out of there, there may be nothing to take before very long. And that, I think, is just part of what the Honorable Lady was saying, but it's not something that we can address and put right by taking measures ourselves here. I think we need to think what we can do to ensure that the seriousness of the situation is understood by our people, and that we collectively try to make our people understand it. There are people who believe what I am saying all over the world, but they're all minority voices. We need to make those voices louder.
Yeah, I remember we were sitting on the debate before I called the minister to this man. The Honourable Dr. John Cortez.
I would like to thank all the contributors to this debate for what is, despite some interventions, clear support for the climate change. And in particular, I would like to thank my friends and colleagues. And in many ways, mentor, the Honourable Sir David Sharma, for taking the message beyond our thoughts, as he always does. So I see as an environmental message undertaken. It's about investment, as what was my first reference to the Honourable Mr. Simpson. I have to reassure him that there is no cause for concern. And certainly, if and when the climate fund, which I want to happen, comes into place, it will be provided for perfectly well, and that the incorporation of a climate expert is not going to be just in that fund. But I will be talking about the committee in a minute. One thing that the Honourable Member did not do is actually welcome that the organization to create for the fund, which I think is very important. In relation to the Honourable Trevor Howard's question on the form of the committee, I think we must realize that the committee has to be created and that there is provision for regulations to determine the status, constitution, and membership of the committee. This will happen so it does not rule out the possibility of a body corporate, although I don't think that is the kind of committee that certainly can do this. I think that what I'm looking at is an advisory committee that's made up of experts. And some of these experts, because of the nature and the specialist nature of it, may not necessarily be in or from the whole thing. We may call an international expert to form part of that committee. So that is the angle that I'm looking at. And I think that when the composition is announced, I think that the Honourable Member will most certainly welcome it. The other one would be very valid point. Clearly, since the Department of State was amended the target from 80% in 2050 to 100% in 2045, that is a statutory target of the bill. But the climate model still stands, and the intention approved by Parliament and certain minister to aim for the more ambitious target of carbon neutral by 2030 and reduce emissions by 2035. I think what I must say, Mr. Speaker, is that I have recently commissioned a study which will look at the some targets that we have set in the motion and in the bill which we hope to pass today. And it will actually translate those targets into what definite action has to be taken. I expect to receive that report by the end of August, and I will share it with the member opposite. And I think that will explain away a lot of the concerns that I've raised, because this certainly is evident. But the bill also provides, Mr. Speaker, that in modifying targets, they may only be modified if the targets are higher, that is more ambitious, and they cannot be modified in the opposite direction. And it may be that based on the result of that report, we would look at doing that, because that would provide advice to the committee which they would make the presentation. I want to think of what the Honourable Lady said, that is down to detail, clearly about the electric vehicles. If we think that we have waited to do all those different things that will come into play, we would not have had this bill before
which is that they've been furloughed to set a target for the year 2015 and interim target for the year 2030, and to provide for progress targets for the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions to establish committee on climate change, to confirm power of ministers to impose climate change duties on public bodies, to make further provision about mitigation of and adaptation to climate change, to make provision about energy efficiency, to make provision about the reduction of recycling of waste, to make other provision about climate change, and for climate purposes to be read a second time. Those in favor? Those against? Carried. The climate change 2019. Now we say it's until 3:15 this afternoon.